excited to be here this morning and share with you on Mark 5. And I just want to say I love this chapter. So I hope you've enjoyed studying it this week in preparation for the discussion today. I love this chapter because it's about the ones who have nowhere else to go. I put that on the title of your outline that's on your tables. And don't we all, at sometimes in our life, feel like we have nowhere else to go? I kind of feel that way a lot, actually. But many of you may have heard my story if you've been at women's retreats. And so I won't go in and tell you the whole thing, but I will tell you about a time I had nowhere else to go. And that was a few years back when I found myself in a really desperate situation. Almost every single detail in my life was falling apart. And those details included my marriage that was unraveling. My parents' marriage had completely dissolved at that point. My father-in-law died. My mother-in-law had a heart attack. One of my best friends betrayed me. And all during that time, we also sold our house and moved. While my husband traveled, I had to pack everything up with three small children. And during this time, as you might be able to imagine, I started having panic attacks and dealing with depression. So you could say that I definitely had nowhere else to go. And in a room like this full of women, I know that many of you have probably experienced a time in your life where you had some sort of bottoming out, where you also had nowhere else to go. And it's in these times when we need our faith most desperately. And as I was thinking about this, I realized that it's actually in these times when our faith can flourish the most. I was thinking about faith in studying this lesson, and I was reminded of a friend several years ago whose name was Rebecca. And I didn't know her very well, but she invited me to a prayer group. And I felt kind of insecure because I didn't know the women who would be there, and prayer is kind of an intimate thing, so I didn't know what to expect. But I went to the prayer group because this woman was so inviting, and she had such wisdom. She was an older woman. And when we started praying, she took out a pottery bowl, and it was full of tiny seeds. And she explained that these were mustard seeds. And she said that often when she would pray, in her private prayer time, she would hold the pottery bowl of mustard seeds and just put her hand in the bowl and just feel the seeds. So I don't know if you've seen mustard seeds before, but they look like that. Do you guys want some too? I'll vacuum. So as you can see, they're really, really tiny. And and she was referring to a passage in Matthew 17 when Jesus compares our faith to a mustard seed. Jesus said, "For truly I say to you, if you have faith like the grain of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." So as I was thinking about this, I was reminded of that passage in Hebrews 11, the faith chapter. And I was reading through it, and I noticed that every single person in that chapter, who was supposed to be in the Faith Hall of Fame, and they are, was very imperfect, except maybe Enoch. I don't know very much about him, but he was seemed like a pretty, you know, God took him up and everything. So I was looking at who they were, and we had a prostitute. We had someone who was passed out drunk. We have a liar. We have someone who sacrificed the safety of his wife to save his own skin. We have someone who laughed at God, a lifelong deceiver, a few murderers, an adulterer, idolaters, a very wimpy leader, and an impulsive and lustful judge. So I thought, why did they get to be in the faith chapter? And I realized, which is, you know, obvious to most of us in here, it's not really about us, our faith. And when I was growing up in the Christian church, like Rachel, I grew up, I don't remember not being a Christian, I always thought somehow that faith was something I could muster up. And if I just try harder, then I can build my own faith. And you always hear, so-and-so has such a strong faith. But according to Jesus, all we need is faith as tiny as a mustard seed. So what's the secret? If it's true we can't try harder to build our own faith, how do we build our own faith? I'm certain it's not about me trying to be perfect, but there is a dance to it, and there's definitely something that we can do to build our faith. And it's not about us, it's about knowing who the hero is. If you know who your hero is, your whole life is defined. Like Jesus said with the mustard seed, it's not about the size of your faith, it's about the size of your God, the size of your hero. So as we study Mark 5, I'd like to look at this hero and get to know him deeper and deeper as a catalyst of growing our faith. So I'm going to turn to Mark 5. Our story starts in verse 1, and we're going to look at three individuals who were all in desperate situations where they had nowhere else to go. So in verse 1, they came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. So the Gerasenes, if you remember studying last week when there was a big storm on the sea and the disciples were scared and they woke up Jesus, this is right after that. So they were traveling in that storm to get to the Gerasenes. And the Gerasenes was a Gentile community. So it was a different place for him to go where he wouldn't have been, it wouldn't have been a Jewish reaction. It would have been a different climate, socially, politically, just different than being in the synagogue area. So when Jesus stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke down the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. And the herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and people came to see what had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. And they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you, and how he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. So as I was looking at this story in the context of faith, I was really confused, because usually Jesus heals as a response to someone's faith, and I couldn't find any. So I looked at the context of the story, and I saw that before the story, we had a lot of stories about faith. Last week we talked about parables, and the mustard seed was in last week's lesson, and on the sea in the storm, Jesus' response to the disciples was, "Where is your faith?" And then after the pigs, we have two huge stories of faith that we'll be talking about next. So I thought, where's the faith? There has to be faith, right? Jesus was healing. And I finally realized I was looking for it in the wrong place. There's no evidence that this man had any faith. No one around him even had any faith that we know of. This man had basically become a huge nuisance and an annoyance to the town. The only evidence of faith we can see in this story is in the demons. And before you think I'm going all like heretical on you, just let me explain what I'm trying to say. In verse 8, Jesus was talking to the demon, not the man, when he said, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And the demon's response was, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" The term used here for Most High comes from the Hebrew word El Elyon and is used throughout the Old Testament, referring to God's sovereignty and the fact that no one is higher, more exalted, or more powerful than he is. The demons believed this. We don't usually think of demons as having faith, but James also talks about this in James 2 when he says, "Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. If you believe that God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder." When I read this, I was very skeptical, and I thought, there's no way demons have faith. Or is belief different than faith? So I decided to go to the Greek, and I looked up the two words that James used in this text, and they're actually the same root word, which is pistis, which means faith. So James really was talking about the faith of demons. And of course, clearly we're not talking about saving faith, because their faith was only intellectual. But we all have faith in something. But what do we have faith in? I thought this was incredibly beautiful and hopeful that Jesus could even use the unregenerate faith of demons for his glory. And it showed me that no situation is beyond hope. The next thing that happened in the story is that the demons asked permission to enter a herd of pigs, which Jesus granted. The pigs threw themselves into the sea and they drowned, and we find the man completely restored. So at the end of the story, we really see two responses. The first response we see is fear, and we see this in the herdsmen. When they saw him, they begged Jesus to leave. And I thought that was a very interesting response, because this man would have been a huge annoyance to the town, and he was that way for many years. People may have been afraid for the safety of their families or their community. He was totally out of control. And one would think that they would feel safe again and grateful to be rid of such a wickedness in their community. Yet they just want Jesus away from them. As I was studying this and reading what other authors have said, we can guess that the reason was financial. 2,000 pigs is a lot of capital, and it would have affected the entire economy for the herdsmen. So most likely, the price of saving one man was not worth their financial sacrifice. The second response we see is from the healed man, and he begged Jesus to let him follow him. When he's seen after his healing, he's found sitting at the feet of Jesus, which is the stance of a disciple. The other thing I noticed about this was that the two responses use the same Greek word. The word beg, when they begged Jesus to leave, and then the man begs to stay with Jesus, is the Greek word parakaleo, which is also translated prayed. So on one side, people are praying for him to leave in fear, and on the other side, someone's praying to be a disciple. And isn't that the same as we see today in the responses of people to Jesus? Either they want him to leave, or you want to pray to stay with him. So as we've seen our hero in this story, we've learned a few things about him in this encounter. The first thing I saw was that he seeks out people who seem beyond hope. The demon-possessed man didn't even have the strength to save anything about himself, totally beyond hope. We also saw that he crossed social, political, and cultural lines in order to seek the lost. And that when he heals completely. He didn't just get rid of the demons, but he restored the whole person. No obstacle can keep Jesus from finding someone who needs to be found. So the second encounter we see is Jairus. And the next story begins in verse 21, which says, when Jesus crossed again in the boat to the other side, so he crossed to the Gerasenes, and now he's going back to where he was last week in your story. A great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. He had just healed the demons, as we know. It didn't exactly go very well with the people. And so he crossed back to the western side, which was a Jewish community. In verse 22, it says, then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet, implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hand on her so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. So here we come face to face with a man who has nowhere else to go. He's confronted with really our greatest fear, which is the death of a loved one, and more specifically, the death of a child. The news of this was inconsolable to him. Many of us in this community have been in this inconsolable place, especially in Durango. This past year, we've lost several young mothers. We've lost children. We've lost parents. Most recently, we lost a beloved school teacher. Our community has been overwhelmingly touched by the pain of death in recent months. So Jairus is in this place, fearing the death of his daughter. He was also the ruler of the synagogue, which is a really big deal. It meant he was in charge of the supervision of the reading of scriptures. His name means he will arouse or waken, which is kind of a preview of what's going to happen next in his life. When Jairus meets Jesus, he has to cast away all his dignity. I mean, it's like the Pope or something. I mean, not quite, okay. But he had to cast aside what all the religious rulers who he knew would think of him. An upstanding Jew would only go to the temple to talk to Yahweh if they had an important request. Yet he knows that that's not enough for him in this situation. His greatest request, which is the life of his child, causes him to forego all the synagogue stuff that he had grown up learning and find out Jesus, who is the only one who could do something about it. When the life of your child is threatened, your world instantly collapses and you're resolved to do anything. Many of you probably know that my son Johnny has a life-threatening peanut allergy, and this reminded me of the first time when he was exposed to peanuts. We were in a grocery store, and I didn't know he was allergic, but he started swelling up, full body hives, rasping, and a kind woman at the grocery store told me, "You better get to the ER right now," and I flipped. He was only 14 months old, so he couldn't talk or tell me what was going on. I can't even tell you. I think I was like throwing groceries everywhere. I just had to get to the ER. That was the only thing I could do. I would have done anything to get to the ER. Nothing else mattered. He was fine. I mean, he has a peanut allergy, but it turned out fine, just telling you that. So Jairus is in this situation, and his encounter with Jesus is really his only hope. If you look in the text at that moment, there's no verbal response from Jesus. And that actually is a picture of how critical the situation is. There's no time to talk about it. Jesus just leaves with him. And the picture is kind of like Jesus is the ambulance, and it's the only way to save his daughter. And they're going to be heading to the ER to save his little girl. So then we have a huge interruption. Our story happens starting in verse 24. Which says, "And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and who had suffered much under many physicians, and had spent all she had. And she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, 'If I touch even his garments, I will be made well.' And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, 'Who touched my garments?' And his disciples said to him, 'You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, "Who touched me?"' And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, 'Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease.'" So we have to remember that we have Jairus in the background, and his little girl is dying. And to him, he's on the way to the ER to save her. Yet, here we come to a complete stop in the story. And Mark's literary way that he did this is brilliant, because he goes into a full detail description in the narrative, which makes the reader come to a complete halt. It's like a red light, and forces the readers to focus on this unnamed woman rather than Jairus. The word that is used of the crowd when Jesus is thronged or pressed in is literally the word choke. It's the same word used in the parable of the sower that you studied last week, when the weeds choke the seeds. So Jesus was being choked in by the crowd. The passage goes into great detail about the woman, everything really but her name. We find out that she's spent all her wealth. She's been totally humiliated under the hands of all the physicians she's been to. She's been rendered unclean. Every single thing she touched was unclean. Everything she sat on was unclean. She was literally cut off from her people, all relationships, worship, small group, prayer, Taco Bell, everything. She's just cut off from everything. She was an outcast. If she were in our time, we wouldn't have seen her here at Bible study since 2004. She'd been afflicted for 12 years. So this pain that she carried is bad enough, embarrassing. But I think the inner torment was even worse because of the shame she carried. I think as females, when we suffer something like this, there's a shame that's really unlike any other. I'm sure many of us, including myself, can understand this in light of abuse victims. It's an undeserved pain, and the shame that you feel in this kind of pain walls up a woman in privacy and seclusion. This is a pain that isolates and puts a woman in a prison where she's left alone. I love this story because in many ways this is my story. I feel like I am this woman. Even her number, 12 years, is my number. For the first 12 years of my marriage, I suffered the shame and hiding due to an abusive situation in my life that happened in my teenage years. For any of you who have suffered in this way, you can understand a woman's embarrassment, her vulnerability, and her isolation. There's literally nowhere else to go. She needed an encounter, and Jesus was her only hope. So as I was thinking about this woman, I thought, what could possibly give her the courage to break all the rules in her society? She would have had to risk being jeered at, rejected, embarrassment, as if she hadn't already experienced those things. What could have motivated her to step out into that crowd? She was the one with nowhere else to go. She knows that this is her last encounter that she has left. And then she believes in the power of Jesus' holiness. When she touched the hem of his robe, she totally reversed the theology of the whole system in the Jewish community. When someone is unclean, everything that they touch becomes unclean. So when the unclean touches the clean, it defiles what it touches. Yet when she touched Jesus, it was all backwards. Jesus was so holy that her touch didn't make him unclean, but it made her clean. So it's a great reversal. One touch of the holy made the foulest clean. The text says that she immediately felt in her body that she had been healed, and that immediately Jesus turned around and asked who touched him. So I thought, okay, if Jesus is the sovereign Lord of the universe, omniscient creator, who knows our hearts and minds, did he really not know who touched him? And if he did know who touched him, why did he ask? If he felt the healing power go out of him, why didn't he just keep going? After all, she was healed. He knew that she was healed. And remember, he's the ambulance. He's on a mission. He has his father probably like tapping his fingers in the background. The reason he stopped was because his relationship with her was more important than her physical healing. He stopped because he's never too busy or encumbered to seal a relationship. And he stopped for her, but really this is written for me and for you. He stopped because he'll always stop for us when we're at the end of our rope, when we have nowhere else to go, and we know that reaching for the hem of his robe is our only hope. In order for her to reach out, she had to let go of her veil and come out in the open. It says she came out in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. So she's in a crowd trying to remain anonymous, yet one touch not only brings her physical healing, but it gives her the courage to be known. So at the beginning of this message, when I was talking about the panic attacks and when I was at the end of my rope, I got a letter from a friend, and she said, "It's time to put away your cape." And I realized that I was hiding behind all my efforts to be good and to do good, to be a good Christian woman, and I had all these capes that I wore, like Superwoman. It got me nowhere, and instead it landed me with panic attacks in my closet. I was totally unable to keep up with the things I did that made me feel worthy. I was literally wiped out. I could no longer do activities, volunteer at my kids' school, church work. I was done. I mean, I was in depression. I couldn't do anything. So I was left with nothing to show for myself, nothing to make God love me, I felt. I had nothing to offer. And it was here in this place that I finally encountered Jesus in a different way than I ever had before. He was more than enough, and my weakness became my greatest gift, to know Jesus in his suffering in a way that I had not previously understood. Something about this Jesus gave the unnamed woman the courage to come out in fear and trembling and to tell him the whole truth. His response to her, "Daughter, your faith has saved you. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." The word affliction means a whip or a scourge. And what he was really saying was that he identified with the affliction she felt. Jesus didn't give her a name. He gave her an identity by calling her daughter. She is the only person in the Gospels that Jesus called daughter. He gives her this title, and with the title, he brought her back into community. He brought her back into family. And 12 years of pain and impurity was healed with one touch. So what we can learn about our hero from this story is that Jesus is safe when you feel vulnerable. He responds to the smallest faith-filled touch, and he's more interested in a relationship than merely fixing your problems. He's never too busy to stop in the middle of what he's doing to respond to your cry. And when he heals, he restores the whole person. So meanwhile, back to our story, Jairus is watching this whole thing happening, worried about his daughter. If you can imagine riding in an ambulance, your child is dying, and then suddenly the driver stops to help someone cross the road or something. He must have been coming out of his skin. In verse 35, it says, "While he was still speaking, there came a ruler from the house who said, your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the little girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. So while Jesus was still talking to the woman, Jairus got the news that his daughter was dead, and his worst nightmare had come true. While he's standing in agony, watching Jesus take his time with the woman, his daughter died. Yet when Jesus overheard what they said, his response was, "Do not fear, only believe." The word believe here is a present tense verb, which actually means continue to believe. What he's doing is asking Jairus to overcome his fear. And the woman who may have been seen as an impediment was actually exactly what Jairus needed. He needed her faith when they told him that his daughter was dead. Otherwise, he may have just agreed with the messengers. Why bother the teacher anymore? It would have all been over. Yet because of this seeming interruption, Jairus watched another person be healed, which gave him the hope that the same could be done for him. What is seen as a waste of time or hassle or a delay was actually the avenue to build the faith that he needed. So when he arrived, he heard the mourners wailing. These were professional mourners, which was very common in that time period. There's a list of things we notice about them, which I think you might have done in your homework. But Jesus moved right past them because it was a fake display, and he went into the real, which was inside the house. When he came to the girl, we were told that she's 12 years old. Our number today. Jesus said to her, "Talitha kum," which meant, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." Talitha is an endearing and affectionate name, and it can be translated tender little lamb. So when Jesus called her this, he was showing himself as the future shepherd for her, but also the one that Israel had been prophesied. Like the unnamed woman, this little girl received more than a name from Jesus. He not only brought her back to life, but he became her shepherd and savior. To conclude in these stories, we've seen Jesus come in when three different people have nowhere else to go. From the stories, we see that faith alone is their only answer, and we also see that faith is born by delay. God's sovereign delays, when we lose all hope to fix our own lives, is when we need a true savior to come in and rescue us. For the demon-possessed man, it was when all hope was lost. He was powerless to save himself, and he had nowhere else to go. For the woman, it was 12 years of isolation and shame, and at the end of her rope for a cure, where she had nowhere else to go. For Jairus, it was when his religious activities and leadership were worthless to save a dying child, and he had nowhere else to go. My story was 12 years as well, as I mentioned earlier. Like the woman, I had seen doctors. After 12 years, God brought me a counselor, and I was healed within weeks after 12 years. I don't know why I had a 12-year delay, but I do know this, that delay is a tool that God uses to build faith. Coming to a place where we have nowhere else to go prepares us to meet our hero and to recognize him in ways that we couldn't have done earlier. We've seen our hero, Jesus, in these stories. So where in your life do you need a hero? And where do you feel like you have nowhere else to go? It could be your family or job, kids. We as women carry a lot of weight. And if you've come to the place where you have nowhere else to go, you are in good company because we have a hero. In conclusion, I'd like to read the benediction poem, which I have printed out on your outline, a sort of homecoming. Who may dwell on your holy hill, whose pilgrimage becomes a sort of homecoming? The prodigal son who despises the pig pen and the Samaritan who calls his enemy brother, the hemorrhaging woman, the little girl, and the man who believes and begs mercy for his unbelief, the demon-possessed, the adulteress, and the leper who can't feel his own pain, the one whose faith is small like a mustard seed, and the one whose tears fall like rain on dirty feet. Who may dwell on your holy hill, whose pilgrimage becomes a sort of homecoming? The ones with nowhere else to go. We shall not be moved ever. Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much for this passage. Thank you for teaching us through others who have nowhere else to go. Thank you for showing us that when we get there, you're waiting. I pray for the discussion groups that you would hover and bless the time. In your name, amen.